everybody, and welcome to our Saturday morning podcast. Two good guests today. Bill Carter, the former New York Times media writer, and now contributes, has his own show, Sirius XM, as well. Some fascinating thoughts on the world of Netflix, sports, politics, how the virus is affecting all of those. But first, Dan Wetzel, Yahoo sports columnist, executive producer, Killer Inside, the Netflix docuseries on Aaron Hernandez, and also the best-selling author of Epic Athletes, a series for young readers. We begin with Yahoo sports columnist here on Saturday morning, Dan Wetzel. So you wrote a piece this week, Dan, on Yahoo about 27% of the first two rounds of the NFL draft were kids from Texas, but none were kids from UT or A&M. My initial takeaway was Texas eventually will be fine. The state has passion for football, produces a lot of good football players. The state supports football. It's just about the Longhorns and A&M getting the right coaches, and perhaps they do now. My takeaway is the bigger issue is California, where the governor isn't as pro-football. The state is increasingly distracted, especially Los Angeles, with so much vibrant, dynamic pro sports in town. I think Texas will be fine. I wonder about the lousy Pac-12 conference television deal, about the real disinterest and distraction in Los Angeles of college football and basketball. Let's start with the first part, Texas. Do you think they'll eventually be fine?
Yeah, absolutely. The talent is there, as we said. When you have 27% of the first two rounds of the draft played at Texas high schools, and that's just an incredible statistic. It's one state. I know it's a big state. But that level of talent is laying there. They just didn't go to Texas or Texas A&M.
Right. Now,
those coaches have been replaced. Part of that is development. There's a lot of things that go into it. But the reason everybody in college football sits there every year, Texas is back, and fans get tired of hearing it because they aren't. But when Texas gets back and when Texas gets it right, or Texas A&M, if they ever get it right, they can be dominant. And that's why. It's one thing to have five-star recruiting rankings. It's another when the NFL is sitting there saying, yeah, more than one quarter of all the best players in the country are from your high schools. So it's there. They've got the money. They've got the will. They've got it all. It's just a real strange anomaly. And explains where they're at.
California was second, I believe. There's a different sensibility. It's a more liberal state. It really cares about women's soccer and volleyball and track and field. I don't know the future of college football in California. Am I being hyperbolic and overly dramatic?
So I think there'll be talent in California because you still have so many players. There's enough, you know, you just have the population of California is so enormous. One out of every eight Americans live in California or something close to that. There is still a lot of talent. Now, it is a different demographics than other states and different things. So there'll be talent there, but I do agree, how much does football matter? Are you ever going to, you know, is Cal Berkeley ever going to fill their stadium again or things like that? Does it just matter the way it does? You know, University of South Carolina sells out 80,000 seats. They aren't really even that good. They're not getting that. But there is still the talent to do that. Will people want to play Pac-12 football if it doesn't matter in all these states? I think what you've kind of seen, you know, oddly, is Oregon's doing very well. Utah is doing very well. Places like that where maybe it matters a little bit more than the LA schools. Now, the biggest thing here is, look, if they sit there and name Urban Meyer the next head coach at USC,
it solves everything.
It's a total game changer. USC's failure to produce right now is the biggest problem the Pac-12 has.
Yeah,
they're not the SEC that can have five different signature programs that could jump up and win a national title at any moment. So that if one of them is down, it's okay. USC is by far the big dog, and they have to have it, and they have to have football matter in LA. And they have to be able to fill that Coliseum up and make it matter for TV and everything. And right now, USC is not that program. But all the tools are there, just the same as Texas. They get a different coach or we'll give Clay Helton a chance if he figures it out, it will matter, and they'll start doing it. But it is a different landscape than when Pete Carroll was there. He basically, USC Trojans back then were the pro football team of L.A.,
yeah,
the closest thing. Now you got two teams. It's just a whole different dynamic. And so people like pro sports there. It's a little bit more like the northeast part of the country where, you know, no, they don't care about college football in Boston. They don't care about college football in New York. They care about the Jets and the Giants and the Patriots and those things. I think that's kind of the case out in L.A.
Could, Dan, the new NCAA ruling on name, image, and likeness, could it be a competitive advantage for the Pac-12 because you have your Googles and your Facebooks and your Apples and your YouTubes all based out here, your Netflix, you have all these media companies out here? Or do you think that is just a boon for college football holistically?
I think a lot of the money in college in this name, image, and likeness deal is going to be social media. And well, everyone talks about, well, you could be the sponsor of a car dealership or something like that. Those are really finite, and it takes a while to kind of get that deal going. For a Trevor Lawrence to be the face of South Carolina Ford dealers or something like that. Social media, as we know, can overnight you can become a star and you become an influencer. And so I think the proximity to those tech companies, does that help? Maybe, but I think those tech companies, you know, it's such an organic thing that I don't know that it really matters. You know, you can become a superstar out of anywhere. And so it's really more the platform that a school could provide in terms of that. And the way the Pac-12 TV media deal is and the way it's crowded, I'm not sure that you aren't more exposed being the quarterback at Boise State than the quarterback of most of the schools in the Pac-12. Boise State seems to be on TV every single week, and I don't know that that's the case for Washington State or for Oregon or whatever. So, or certainly a lot closer than you want. So I don't think that tech factor is going to be a big deal for it. Although I do think tech will be what drives this going forward, because if you can amass a million followers, and you can do that in a week if you want. If something happens, that's a very powerful thing.
Dan Wetzel, Yahoo Sports columnist. College basketball had a bad week. We see clearly top high school players, many, now jettison college basketball and move to the G League. There's some upsides. You play against better players, pros. You get paid. The downside is you don't have this college basketball platform. The only reason I know who Zion is Duke. And also, I think the coaching's probably better at the high-end schools than it is G League. That would be my guess. But I blame the NCAA here, its rigidity. This was not – they've always been bureaucratic and slow-footed, and somewhat – there's a rigidity with the NCAA. They don't move off stuff, like a little bit like baseball sometimes. It's their DNA. We saw this thing happening 5 years ago when, you know, Gatorade came to sponsor the league, and they called it the G League. They were clearly trying to make this – a more financially solvent, reputable league, and clearly going right after college basketball. I don't think it kills college basketball, because I think its regular season has largely been punctured for the last decade with the one-and-done stuff. But what was your takeaway on an aggressive move by the G League and the increasing talent drain in college basketball, Dan?
Right. So I agree with you on almost all that. College basketball will survive with its pockets of fans. There's still Kansas fans and Dayton fans and, you know, whatever, that they're going to root for their school no matter what. But to break through and get those big TV numbers, to get that national consciousness, you need great players. And that's why when Zion Williamson's at Duke, all of a sudden everyone's watching Duke, because you're like, what, you know, this guy could do something tonight I've never seen. You need Zion Williamson's. What I thought this week and this people jump into the G League show is how the top players don't value whatever it is college basketball brings to the table, and they are looking for a way out. And college basketball sat there for 70 years and just said, well, we get the best players. You know, you come here and this is the best spot. It isn't anymore. The top guys want out. So you, whatever it is you have done, you're not selling yourself to recruits anymore. Like, recruits are sitting there saying, I got a better path. And it goes a little bit to where you talk about with the excitement in L.A. and how it can hurt a conference. Like, the kids in California are leaving to go to the SEC because they're looking and saying, that's big-time football. This isn't, right? So these guys are going, this is big-time basketball, or this is the best path. And some of these things that the college basketball, I think, could have done that haven't, or maybe they should. But I've been saying for years, like, things like, you know, try to work out something the way they do in the NHL where you can get drafted coming out of high school and still play college basketball. If you look in if you look in college hockey,
yeah,
there's a ton of first-round draft picks even, let alone second-round guys that are picked that go and say, I'm going to the University of Wisconsin anyway. Let your kids work out for pro teams in the summer. What if the top college players could spend a summer on the summer league, the NBA summer league,
yeah,
get paid as an intern, more opportunity to work out with personal trainers? These kids now are looking and saying, this is a better path for me to develop into an NBA player than going to play for Mike Krzyzewski, than going to play for John Calipari. Now, maybe this new name, image, and likeness deal helps that, because you can become a star at Kentucky or Kansas or Duke,
yeah,
and make a lot of money. Zion would have been worth a lot of money anyway coming out of high school, but he was worth a lot more because of what Duke did for him,
yeah,
what March Madness did for him. But they have to start selling themselves. They're not the only game in town, and we've been ringing that bell for a long time, but they ignored it. And now I think you got to sit there and say, whatever it is, we're not getting across to these kids that this is a good path for you.
I could also make an argument that this is problematic for the NBA. One of the things that hurts baseball, you have a draft. They then take the kids, put them in a largely anonymous minor league system. The best players go to bad teams. And I don't know who Jose Altuve is until I finally see him in the playoffs years later. Whereas the G League's an anonymous minor league system, so you go from high school to the G League. I have no idea who you are. If you're good, you get drafted to a really bad franchise, and I don't see you for 5 years until you make the playoffs. The NFL embraces college football. I will watch a struggling quarterback on a bad team, Baker Mayfield, because I have a visceral connection to him. I think the NBA, I'm happy for the player and his rights and getting paid, but isn't this a problem with baseball? Is that if you don't have a platform to advertise your minor league players, Zion, you know, at Duke, that's his platform. Is that you're just jamming guys into a G League. It's like double-A baseball in Midland, Texas. I'm not going to watch this stuff. I think the NFL's got it right, Dan. Here, use college football as a free marketing platform. Let them develop the kids. Some thoughts on that?
The marketing is absolutely true. I mean, you will tune in next year, week one, you'll sit there and say, wonder how Joe Burrow.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God. Right? I will be on every Bengal game, and I know it'll be 10 Pacific. They'll put him in the 1 o'clock window. Dan, I'll be on every Bengal game.
Wonder how he's doing.
Yes.
Hey, Chase Young got it, a sack or what?
Yes.
You know, which, of course. And so that's the beauty of the NFL, and that's what helps drive full interest and ratings. That's not watching the Ravens play. The big number is the Ravens-Chiefs game, right? But it's lifting all the boats. So that other than how Joe Burrow does, I don't care what Cincinnati Bengals do. Okay? Like, not interested.
Right.
But I am now.
Yes.
Because they had this guy that I know. And that, obviously, how many Pelican games did we have to get forced on when they had the NBA season when Zion wasn't there?
But
it was like, I'm like, what is this game? Oh, right, Zion, but he's hurt.
So clearly,
the NBA has benefited greatly from this. What their problem is, I remember Adam Silver saying this a few years ago, Ben Simmons goes to college basketball, number one pick, doesn't make the NCAA tournament. Markelle Fultz goes to the college basketball, Washington, doesn't make the NCAA tournament, number one pick. They started getting these top guys who are just picking schools, probably out of sneaker affiliations more than anything else, or some kind of deal. They weren't even getting the marketing that you got when it's like, holy crap, you got to see this Derrick Rose guy, let alone going back to, you know, Patrick Ewing or Michael Jordan. But, you know, Derrick Rose shows up and he almost wins the national championship in Memphis, and everyone watches and goes, this kid is thrilling to watch. All of a sudden, these guys were going to college, but they weren't getting anything out of it. They weren't getting good training. They weren't getting promoted and all that. And so it's that really caused the NBA to say, what is going on here? Because we're not getting out of college basketball what we once were. And I don't know if that's just a short-term fluke, but it certainly raised bells in the NBA office when they're 2 years in a row, their number one pick never saw March.
Yeah. Dan Wetzel, Yahoo Sports columnist. Going back to college football, which I don't know if we're going to have a season or not, but I'll throw this at you. The commissioner of the SEC came out this week, late this week, and said, you know, I mean, if all the states don't line up, do you have to have everybody aligned? Basically saying, if the Pac-12 doesn't want to play, so what? Let me theorize this, that the SEC is big enough, rich enough, great enough, and interesting enough that the SEC could say, we're going to have a season. Our footprint, our states have not been as affected by the virus. We have conservative pro-business governors. We're just going to have an SEC season. And I think about this, Dan, and I think to myself, I would watch it. The SEC is college football. If the SEC, and this is just a theory of mine, goes out and says, we're just going to have an SEC season. 9 games, that's what we play, SEC championship, because the SEC, Dan, does not want to play in the spring because they have the most NFL prospects. And if an NFL prospect could get hurt in February, he can't get healthy by the combine in March. So it does not behoove the SEC to play in the spring. They would be in the crosshairs of many star players saying, I'm passing. I'm not playing until late March or early April. So I'll just throw it out to you. College football has a history of independence. BYU, Navy, Notre Dame, they've been independent. It works in this sport. What if the SEC, Dan, just said, we're having a season. We don't care what the rest of the sport does. If California's governor, you know, puts a stamp, nope. If Northeast governors and the ACC, nope. The idea the SEC could just by themselves be college football, I know I would watch, Dan. Your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, they'll do it. 100%, go it alone. You don't need the other. It's 130 teams in this thing. That's the beauty and the beast of college football is it's completely absurd. There's 130 teams. Okay, we have big state schools, religious institutions, military academies, private, you know, elite institutions. It makes no sense at all that all these things are involved. They're in all the states. There is no way all 130 schools are playing football.
That's right.
Like, how do you even try to plan for football right now at Rutgers? I mean, they are under a complete, you know, it's a absolute panic there, and it should be. This is where it hit. It didn't hit Starkville, Mississippi like that. It's just reality. So now where we're going to be in the fall, maybe it's big in Starkville and no longer big in Rutgers. I don't know. But there's no way they're getting all 130 to do this. I think the SEC will absolutely go it alone. And you may even have leagues where you can't do it in one state, or some states will allow fans, but others won't. There's going to be a million variables. But if the SEC can put program out 12 weeks of games, they'll actually get bigger ratings and just have the SEC championship.
Yes.
And call it a day and just say, well, that's it. We don't have a national championship. I also think the Big 12 will jump in mostly. What does Clemson do? Clemson wants to play football. Nobody wants to do this spring thing. Like, if you're Trevor Lawrence, you can't play in the spring.
That's right. Well, if I'm a defensive lineman, listen, I'm a running back. I get dinged up in March. I can't get to the combine. There's no way I'm a Jonathan Taylor. Am I going to do 300 carries, get dinged up in March? Now, he's a great kid. He's never missed a practice. But I could see a lot of these pro kids talking themselves out of it, and I would totally defend them.
Of course. If you know Trevor Lawrence, he loves college football in Clemson as much as any player could possibly love college football or playing college. And I guarantee he's sitting there saying, going into his junior year, we're going to go undefeated. I'm going to win the Heisman. I'm going to win the national championship. This is the dream I've had my whole life, right? And he cares. It's not a selfish move. But if they don't have a season in September, I mean, come on. Like, it'd be ludicrous to sit there. You're the number one draft pick. Don't do anything like that.
Well,
play this weird season where only half the schools are going, and what is this thing? You made a deal. The deal with college sports is it starts in September. So will the SEC do it alone? 100% they'll go it alone. Will half the Big Ten play? Maybe. You know, because here's the thing to remember. Now, you might say, well, that's not fair. You're going to leave Maryland and Rutgers behind? These conferences share money, and every school is desperate for money. So if they play, if eight Big Ten schools can play and they make X number of dollars, that's going to get cut up, presumably.
Great point.
14 ways. Rutgers gets a slice of the pie and says, well, we'll take it because we're broke right now. We just lost our football season. So it makes money for Rutgers if Ohio State's playing. It makes money for whomever. And look, what's happening in New Jersey is not what's happening in Nebraska, and that may switch, but it's too big and diverse of a thing to expect all 130 schools to be playing.
Well, that's why we brought Dan Wetzel on. Thought-provoking, smart. It's a great point on the Big Ten. He's a Yahoo Sports columnist, executive producer of Killer Inside, the Netflix docuseries on Aaron Hernandez. So it's just an absolute pleasure, Dan. Of course, I read your columns every week, multiple columns. So I appreciate you coming on our podcast. I'd love to have you again sometime.
Anytime, Colin. Big fan. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Hope you enjoyed Dan. Bill Carter's around the corner, New York Times former media writer. So many things going on. We want to thank everybody again who has enjoyed these extended podcasts. I think for the time being, at least through the football season and maybe beyond, this Saturday podcast becomes a 45-minute to an hour podcast. We've gotten a lot of great feedback, and we really appreciate it, and we love doing it. So now, Bill Carter. Former New York Times TV and media writer, a CNN analyst, Hollywood reporter, contributor, a Sirius XM host, and his son, by the way, is a successful stand-up comic who's doing very well, I imagine. I see him from time to time or hear from him in Southern California. Bill is joining us. Let me just start with this. This has been a very good...
First, I'll say hi, Colin. Can I say hi?
Yes, you can, Bill. And I'm glad you're doing well. And
yeah.
So this has been a very good time. I tend to think my father used to say recessions were garage sales for the rich. You buy stuff at a discount. So for an Amazon, as business contracts in retail, they'll probably grow over the next 10 years. Similarly with Netflix. This is a very good time for Netflix. Everybody's watching Netflix. But
yeah.
I would pose this question, Bill. If we can't have production for another 6 months, you hit a wall at some point. How is the TV business, the OTTs like Netflix, or, you know, the ABCs and the NBCs and the Foxes, what kind of a battle are they in right now? How dire is it?
Well, they're going to face a gigantic gap, obviously. At some point, they're cleaning out what they have, especially Netflix, which has, you know, a backlog of programming. But they're going to hit a spot where there's nothing in the pipeline, so to speak. I think what's going to happen is they're going to drain whatever they have, and then they'll pump out things as fast as they can. They'll make production, you know, as soon as they're given a green light, production will start up hugely. And all the people who have been out of work, there won't be enough of them to work. I mean, there'll be so much pent-up demand, because let's hope that the creative types have at least been using this time to write things so there's material for them to produce when they get the green light to go ahead. But there will be a period where they're going to have an issue with, you know, original programming.
You've been really the North Star on late night talk show Opinion, Saturday Night Live. These guys are all going virtual now, these late talk shows. Has anybody flourished to you? Has anybody struggled?
Well, they all struggle, because I think it's obviously much more challenging to put on shows this way, you know, by yourself in a house with your wife holding the camera or setting up for you and your kids running through the background. I mean, that's much harder for late night guys.
Right.
And Saturday Night Live had to do their entire – there's no way to do a real sketch interacting with people. You have to have them all separate. So that's another challenge. Given that, I found it kind of creative and interesting. In a lot of cases, it looks clunky, you know, and the comedy, you don't know whether it's landing or not landing, because
Right. Nobody's
laughing, you know.
Like, yeah.
And that's the most awkward part. And I've talked to some of the guys, especially Jimmy Kimmel, who's a very good friend of mine, and you know, it's weird, but it feels like they're still working and they're kind of enjoying it. You know, they kind of enjoying the challenge, the creative aspect of it. And I found myself watching it. I found myself sort of interested in how they're doing it. And it's very informal, you know, and they're wearing some casual shirt and they're, you know, they're hanging out in their rec room. And I think that kind of has an appeal. I don't think you can do it long term that way. To me, the absence of laughter for a comedian is like the absence of oxygen for the rest of us.
Right.
You know, so I can't see how they can continue that much longer. They've been holding their breath for a long, long time.
You know, somebody who I am a fan of and I think he's really flourished is Bill Maher. I think his comedy cuts through because so much of it's social commentary and very pointed and at times very acerbic. Whether I agree or disagree with him, I found Maher of all the, you know, I guess I classify him as a media person. I think Bill has flourished. That's my opinion. Your thoughts?
Well, I think clearly all the guys that focus very heavily on, you know, topical humor have enormous opportunity here. Just enormous, enormous opportunity here. And, you know, that means Colbert too, because Colbert is very on that for sure. But it's also, you know, I mean, like Jimmy Fallon, who does goofy sort of stuff, he's sort of in his element too, if he can find sort of these goofier things to do. I don't know. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, we all think of these shows as a lot of writers sitting in rooms writing stuff and then they decide what to use. Well, that doesn't happen either. I mean, the writers are all sitting separately too, and they're in the same boat. Everybody is individualized in a way that these shows have never had before, and it has led to some interesting things. I just feel like so far it's satisfying, and I think what it's sort of underscored for me is that people really still want to be entertained like this, and they're not paying attention to it. People are still watching it, so you know I'm encouraged by that.
If you were writing your multiple weekly columns for like a New York Times on the media coverage of the coronavirus, it's interesting. Cable obviously is kind of got these tribal smaller followings than network TV. But the overall coverage, we have a president, by the way, who now actively battles media. So that in itself is you know, that's a channel in itself. How do you think the overall coverage has been for a virus that we have a fluid situation, Bill? There's not a lot of knowledge that we know to be true. There's a great deal of speculation, but you have time to fill, and speculation is sort of what we have. Your thought on the overall coverage of it?
Well, I think they've taken it appropriately seriously, other than occasionally the president's network, who just wants to support him, and so whatever he does, they're unquestioning about it. But I think they want to follow what the scientists are saying, and so they're trying to do that. They're trying to say, okay, if we can steer this in any direction, let's hear from people who actually are epidemiologists and people like that, and they are focusing on it. Now, it is pretty much total all day long, right? And I watch a lot of it because that's what I do, but I do think it's interesting that one of the big, huge gains of this are the network evening newscasts. They're only half an hour long, and a lot of people are saying, that's enough for me. I want to see something, but I can't take this all day long. You know, it is kind of great. Every day you tune in, and another several thousand people are on the list who died of this thing. And it's sobering, and it's very difficult. I think one of the things that is really effective has been to me is the stories of these incredible medical staff people. I mean, these people are unbelievable what they do. They're risking their lives, and the emotional part of it when families can't see their loved ones when they're dying, and these, you know, nurses and doctors have to stand in for them. It's really powerful stuff. It's incredibly dramatic stuff.
You know, I was just reading a story about the network news. David Muir is doing very, very well for ABC. In an era where we think the network news anchor is sort of eroding, what do you think the secret sauce of David Muir has been?
I think it's ABC has very strong local stations, which helps him a lot. I don't think his reporting is any more distinguished. And I found David sort of an interesting character because he emerged and was given the job, people didn't really know who he was. And I still think he's not a giant figure. Like, he's winning the rating stuff, but I'm not sure he's as identifiable as, you know, Dan Rather was in his day.
Yeah.
I think ABC has some structural advantages that give them a slight edge. I don't think they're necessarily dominating because of their anchor. But I think it's obviously great for him. He's getting tremendous exposure and all that. So it is great for him. But I do think people are turning back to these anchors, you know, for, you know, reliable information. I think that's definitely happening.
Yeah, because it's mostly opinion-based. And this virus, again, it's not like politics where you have data points where you can discuss going up to an election. There's a lot of making stuff up here and speculation on what works and what does not. Bill Carter is joining us, somebody I really lean on, the author of four great books on late-night stuff, Desperate Network, The Late Shift, Letterman Leno and the Network Battle for the Night, former New York Times and media writer, now does a SiriusXM show, CNN analyst, Hollywood reporter, contributor. You know, it's interesting. So we talked about content, Netflix earlier. I've gone deeper on my sports viewing, my political viewing, and my news viewing over the last 4 or 5 years. My wife, I think it wears her out sometimes. She'll go to the, you know, the Netflix stuff or the Hulu stuff, yeah, or the Amazon Prime. I'm very choosy on that. And I'll give you an example. As much as I love Curb Your Enthusiasm, it tends to be a give it or take it. I don't set my clock to it. There's been a seminal handful of shows: Sopranos, Narcos, Mindhunter, and Billions, that for some reason keep pulling me in. Very strong male figures. I want to talk about Billions, because this is very interesting. They've got legs for me. What is it? Does it work for you? Is it as successful as I think it should be? How? And I just saw their trailer last night. Where are they at on their show?
Well, they have a season. They, fortunately for them, they had an entire season done, so they're in great shape. It is Showtime's strongest show. There's no doubt about it going forward. I mean, I think they want to keep that show really badly. So for them, it's a usually successful show. Incidentally, the show that it's based on, based on Andrew Ross Sorkin, who was a colleague of mine at the Times. And I'm sort of jealous because he must be getting a gigantic check all the time. But it's been very successful for Showtime. I do think you're right that is a show that has a real strong male appeal, and Showtime has done well with those shows. I haven't been hooked by it. It never sucked me in. I like both lead actors enormously.
Oh, I love Paul Giamatti. I think is unbelievable. I think he's
fantastic.
He's absolutely fantastic in everything he does.
Well, you must have interviewed him.
I have not. And I love him.
He's got such a great sports connection, you know.
You know, it's interesting. He is, and I tell my wife this, there's a handful of actors in America, when they're on the screen, I can't stop looking at them. And they don't even have to verbalize their thoughts. It can be facial tics or facial features. I find him to be one of the handful of great actors in America.
He's a fantastic interview, though, as well. He's a very interesting guy. You know, when his father was a commissioner of baseball, he was, you know, like a guy just moving up and acting, and people didn't connect him with that. He's a huge Red Sox fan. I had a great time talking to Paul. I think he's a super guy.
Bill Carter is joining us. So the MJ documentary is getting as much play as any documentary I can remember. Your opinion of it so far?
Oh, I think it's really great. I mean, like everyone else, I'm sort of desperate for sports content. Well, every sports fan anyway. And it just brings back a time when I liked the NBA much more then than I do now. So I just found it fascinating. And it's a little... To me, the way they've done it, where they kind of go back and forth in time, can be a little jarring, maybe. But
yeah, it can be.
Speaking,
yeah.
Generally speaking, I'm impressed by it.
Bill,
how about you?
I think it's very good. I hope they touch on gambling. Because I think it's a component to Michael Jordan's career that needs to be discussed, even if it's refuting rumors, which I didn't believe in. That's the reason he retired. But I think a documentary, I don't necessarily, you know, the term is tell all. I don't need them to go terribly deep on it, because if Michael gambled with friends, he may not want to discuss those gambling friends. But I think it should be, I think the documentarian, Jason Hare, should push on it, right? Like, I mean, you watch documentaries. I don't want it to be too refined and polished. I want to see the Steve Kerr punch with MJ. That needs to be discussed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
I think you, anytime you do something like this, if there's an elephant in the room, you got to address it, right? And with MJ, that was a factor in his career. People talked about his gambling, and whether or not that was why he went to baseball, whatever, which, you know, was so widely speculated, you have to deal with it. I don't think you can ignore it, because people in the back of their minds are thinking, well, when are we going to talk about that?
The NFL held a draft, and there was some initial pushback on the, quote, optics. I'm a believer. My narrative was, listen, America needs hope and optimism, and it's a four-day optimism party. Everybody thinks their team was great. America needs hope. It's a phone business. It's a Zoom business. Let's just do it. There was pushback on the optics. Your thoughts about sports going forward, just from that perspective, forget the medical issues, but that perspective.
Yeah. I had no problem with it at all. I mean, you know, it's not the world's greatest television show,
right. Even
when it was before this. It's just a guy reading, like in a bingo game, reading the bingo number. Oh, I got that number. So there's not inherently a whole lot of drama to it. So it's not, but it was compelling because we hadn't seen any kind of thing that we could root, that attract, you know, dealt with our rooting interests. And if you were a fan of these teams, you still want to find out what they're doing. Someday they're going to play. I want to know what players are going to get. I had absolutely no problem with it. I didn't see why anybody should have any problem with it. It didn't take away anything from what people were doing with the virus, and it didn't put anyone at risk. So there was no reason not to do it, in my opinion. And you could see people were craving it. It was like, you know, why shouldn't – it was like, you know, Thanksgiving dinner for the starving. Like,
right.
Give them something.
Yeah.
Give them something to eat.
Bill Carter. Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say, sports going forward is going to be interesting, because I think the fall is going to be like this massive flood is going to suddenly hit at some point when the NFL is happening and the Masters is happening and the Kentucky Derby is happening and everything is happening sort of at once. So that's maybe something to look forward to if you're a sports fan.
You know, I want to talk for a second about cable. There's obviously what they call cord cutting, which everybody in our industry is very sensitive about. But I had discussed this with somebody recently at my company. I said, if we do have 10 to 12 million people unemployed, it's an enormous audience that's going to be home. That is not terrible for our business, unfortunately. Secondly, with the increased demand for home Zoom webcasting, which I think is a real part going forward of business, I wonder about the big office building going forward. I look at cable and I see the cord cutting, but then I think we're going to have a flood of people home now. Secondly, more people are going to start working from home. Despite the cord cutting, how viable to you is cable going forward?
It's at risk. There's no doubt. There's just no doubt about it. It's at risk because people are paying. Let's talk about ESPN, for example. ESPN charges, I don't know what it is, a pretty hefty fee per month, right? They have had no live sports all this time, none, zero. But there's, are the cable people paying for cable getting a financial break out of it? At some point, that's going to really become a critical issue. It's already hurting. You know, the number of subscribers has fallen off, and those fees are going to fall off. So that is going to be an issue. If, you know, people are paying. You talked about Netflix. If you're paying for Netflix and Amazon and, you know, three other services. And then people say, well, why are you paying this massive cable? A lot of people are going to say, I can't do them all. I got to make a choice.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm a person who technically I could write off anything that I watch, but I'm like, do I need all of these services? You know, do I want to pay for that? I paid for all the sports, you know, here in New York. And, you know, the baseball season isn't on. but it's the Yankees and Mets networks are still on the on my cable bill. So, you know, that's an issue going forward for sure, Colin.
It's interesting, as a presidential election, I think will clearly help MSNBC, Fox News, and perhaps CNN. When I look at those three big cable TV news brands, we clearly MSNBC is where a moderate to a liberal goes. Fox is where somebody that's more right goes. What do you make of CNN, which has gone anti-Trump, or some would say pro-journalism? And what is CNN's brand to you this morning in all of this?
Well, their brand, and I think they've made it completely apparent, is we're going to tell you what's really happening, and we're not going to spin it. Now, in many cases today, you'll see their anchors not holding back. You hear Anderson Cooper say something like, well, the president, what he said there is a lie. And he'll just say that because there's like it's a new normal. It's like you have to come out and say, if something isn't factual, you got to come out and say that. It's working very well. They're up like 183% in their ratings. All the cable news networks are, but that's an enormous boost for CNN. So it is working. And by the way, they also are more international. They have a world brand, and this is a world epidemic.
Yes.
So that has played into their hands as well. I do think it's going to be sort of an interesting thing in the actual political season to see how they deal with this, because I think it's going to be very different from anything we've seen before, especially if we aren't completely, out and about, and we won't be. And it's going to be as ugly as anything anyone has ever seen. I mean, we're all used to negative campaigning, but nothing like what this is going to be, I think.
Bill Carter, formerly of the New York Times, now a Hollywood reporter, CNN analyst, Sirius XM host, author of several books. Yeah, I look forward to billions. I told my wife the other day, she's off news. She can't watch it. It's driving her crazy. And I said,
yeah.
I've found as I've aged, maybe this is a demographic thing, Bill, as I've aged, I seek more politics, more news, and more sports. How about you?
That's not only is that true of you and me, but it's true of virtually everybody, because when you have more reason to lose something, the news becomes more imperative to you.
Oh.
You know, you have investments, you have kids that are being affected, the news becomes much more imperative too. This has always been the case, but it's underscored now because we have the health issue thrown in there. And the older you are, the more risky it is for you, et cetera. This has become a drive thing. Plus, retired people obviously watch more, but now we're all stuck at home. And I think older people are saying, I have a lot to lose in this thing. I got to find out what's going on. And I think there's more of a pressing urge for that.
Bill, anything else you want to promote or anything? Is where can I find you?
Well, I can promote one thing.
Sure.
although I don't have a date for it yet. But I worked with a production company, and we produced a six-part documentary series on the history of late-night TV. And that is going to be on CNN in the next few months. It was supposed to have started by now, but we of course got pushed back by these events. And I think people will really enjoy it. We got most of the people, to sit for interviews. And if you don't know the whole story and all the various things that happened from starting in the 50s all the way up till now, I think people will find it really interesting.
Well, you're the North Star on that for sure. Bill Carter, always love talking to you, and, continued success, and I cannot wait to watch it.
All right. Come on. Call me anytime, Colin. Love to talk to you.
Thanks, everybody. Our Saturday podcast is complete. Dan Wetzel and Bill Carter, loved them both. I got smarter. Hope you did as well, and we'll see you next weekend.